Welcome to Turn a Page, the official comic book club for Nerd Initiative. Each week, the NI Bullpen will be covering the world of comics, talking to creators, deep diving into some fantastic stories, and much more. Now let's hand it over to the team and turn a page.
And what is going on, everyone? It is Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you are tuned in to Nerd Initiative Streaming Network for another edition of Turn a Page, the official comic book club for Nerd Initiative. My name is Ken M. You know me as the host of the ODPH podcast, but I'm also Nerd Initiative's comics editor-in-chief. To my far left, you're right, because it's in his contract, he has to do his own intro.
Coming at you live and direct, straight from the ODPH studios, my name is Off the Cuff Tom, Nerd Initiative's pop culture connoisseur, and Ken, I believe we have a very special manwich going on tonight. Who's the cream filling in our sandwich here?
Yes, joining us, he has been on the past episodes of the ODPH. He is one half of the first couple of cosplay.
That's true.
And he is also our resident comic shop manager.
I've spent so much money because of this man.
Yeah, seriously. The amount of debt we are in is immeasurable. But it is all well worth it. Please give a warm welcome to the one and only Justin Credible Cosplay.
Hi, guys. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. And we had to bring him on because there is one book that, first and foremost, we are all major fans of here at Nerd Initiative.
Yes.
And Justin has been campaigning about this book online, and rightfully so, because it's one of the most fantastic storytelling revisions of a character that you're going to find. It has drama, it has love, it has action, it has suspense, it has everything that you're looking for in a comic with one of the best creative teams behind it, with Kieran Tormey, Matt Herms, and the most underrated letterer in the game right now.
Oh my God.
Lucas Gattoni.
Amazing work.
We have to give him his flowers for that.
So many.
And we are fortunate enough to have the writer of this book on the show. You know his work from such projects as Masters of the Universe Revelations on Netflix, Batman the Long Halloween from WB Animation, Teen Titans Academy, and Flashpoint Beyond from DC Comics, but most importantly, from Alan Scott, the Green Lantern. Please give a warm welcome to the one and only Tim Sheridan. Tim, what is going on?
Tim Sheridan! Yeah!
Oh my God,
I think that sounded real. Hi. Thank you so much for having me on. You guys have been, thank you so much. Your kindness is overwhelming. Really appreciate it.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, your work speaks for itself. Mm-hmm. Alan Scott, the Green Lantern, is one of the best comics out, period, right now. And if nobody's checking it out for whatever reason yet, by the end of the show, trust me, you're going to be clamoring down the dates for March 25th when issue 5 comes out, but you're going to be running to the LCS to go get the back issues of this series. Mm-hmm. And so let's start off.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, if you can find them, because Justin actually has a little story behind that.
Oh, it's true.
Right, well, we'll get it. Yeah.
We are, as of today, I think we only have like 4 issues left on the shelf out of the 4 that have come out. And I mean, like, there's just like issue 2 and 3, and that's it. There are no issue 1s, there are no issue 4s.
It's so bittersweet. It's so bittersweet. It's nice to know people are picking them up. I mean, it's great for retailers, it's great for the book, but, you know, we all want this story to be in as many hands as possible. And so, you know, hopefully there's a trade in our future.
Oh yeah. Oh.
Let's put it out in the universe. Let's manifest it. Let's use our will. Let's get it out there.
If people keep buying like they've been buying the other ones, then yes. Yes.
No, I mean, they should be, because honestly, the story speaks for itself. So why don't we get into it? I mean, how did this whole story come about?
Well, there's two things. Well, they actually, it's kind of the same answer. Like how did the book come about and how did the story come about? You know, I worked with, I had never met the man before, but I worked with, by the way, apologies to everyone. I'm getting over a cold. That's why my voice sounds so sultry. Why I sound like Kathleen Turner right now. I've got a cough drop in as well. I'm not trying to be rude, but I just don't want to hack my way through this. Working on a book with Jeff Johns, a man who I had never met or worked with.
We know that guy. Worked on a book
called Flashpoint Beyond. And I, you know, fell over head over heels in, you know, talent love with him. And we had a wonderful experience with him and Jeremy Adams and they are working on that book and on our editorial team as well, with Marquise Draper and Andrew Marino. And part, you know, this story spins out of all of the three new Golden Age titles, the Jay Garrick book, the Wesley Dodds book, and Alan Scott, as well as, you know, we saw Stargirl and stuff in the JSA, is all kind of connected to the story, you know, we were sort of telling in the background of Flashpoint Beyond that sort of came to the forefront at the end of that series. And but we really didn't know if there were going to be any new Golden Age books, if it was really going to take off, if it was going to happen. And some time passed, and then I got a call from Jeff one day saying, I think we're gonna move ahead and do these new Golden Age titles, and I really would love to talk to you about what, you know, and see if you think you have a story in mind for you know, reintroducing Alan Scott, you know, through the lens that we now see him through in you know, the modern age. You know, Alan Scott came out of the closet several years ago in continuity, but we hadn't seen any stories that really dealt with it. Well, it like, yeah, 11 or 12 years ago on Earth 2, but then in main continuity, yes, just like in Infinite Frontier, I think, you know, a few years ago.
That was a really, really good scene too, because that was just heartbreaking, because, you know, it was Alan Scott coming out to
his kids,
who is like historically the first openly gay character in DC. And I just love that line where it's just like, is it this hard every time? And he's like, nah, man, only the first time, Dad. And that was right here.
Yeah, it was beautiful, but it was so good that I think it made everybody feel like, oh, well, okay, well, what's the story? Like, tell me more. I want to know more about what happened. What has Alan's life been like? Where is it going? And so that kind of sat for a little while before, you know, that call from Jeff, and we started kicking it around, and I said, you know, I wasn't sure at first. I said, I don't know if I really have a story to tell, and I don't. I think the more I sat with it, and the more we talked about it, the more started coming, you know, to the forefront in my mind. One of the things that opened up the door in a big way was when Jeff said, you know, what if he had like a classic, a Golden Age villain that we never met in the comics, the Red Lantern? And we said, oh yeah, yeah. What if he's the Red Lantern because he's the Soviet Union's answer to the Green Lantern? And you know, in the way that Alan Scott, the Green Lantern, is disconnected from the Green Lantern Corps, this Red Lantern is disconnected from, you know, the Red Lanterns that we know in comics continuity. So once we, you know, and then the next thing, and spoilers for folks who haven't picked up the book yet, close your ears now, but stay away from all socials. But the next thing that I said was, you know, knowing it's Alan Scott and knowing his history, his romantic history in continuity, it would be beautifully tragic if his relationship to this villain, this nemesis, the Red Lantern, was more than that of a hero and a villain, but actually had a romantic history or component to it as well. In the way that perhaps Batman and Catwoman have a history that is greater than just being, you know, a hero and a villain, you know, or if you want to even call them that, it's so complicated with those two. but once we kind of, once I clicked in on that, I said, okay, I think I kind of know where we're going. And then I got to work on putting together a story that, like I said, reintroduces Alan Scott. We took a look back. We started a little bit before his official origin that we saw in All American Comics number 16, and then kind of touched on those beats a little bit as well, and then have now been rooted in 1941, just after the formation of the Justice Society. So when I came in, I pitched the story out, and then we got to work.
So interestingly enough, with reintroducing, reinvigorating the franchise, there's a few things that come along with this, especially with this whole 6-issue run. What was the Bible that you were able to twist a few pages with to add to it? And then also when Jeff and, you know, had repitched this in reply, you know, you're doing this wonderful, donation to the Elton John AIDS Foundation. How is it? Was that part of the pitch for you to do this run? Like, there's a little bit of that stuff that I maybe not got the whole memo on. So can you put it on a little post-it note and see what we got?
Yeah. So for me, in terms of, I think I understand the first part of your question, but correct me if I've gone off track here. But
we're live.
In terms of the sort of Bible, the world that I was working with when conceiving of the story, you know, I created a pitch for an outline for the six issues, and you know, broke down the story that way, and by the way, it was, you know, 20 pounds of story in a 5-pound sack. I said there's no way I can possibly do this in six issues. And then when I started, they were like, oh, by the way, it's also only 20 pages an issue. And I said, what?
Mm-hmm. whoa, is only 20 this time?
Yeah, it's the difference between 20 pages and 22 pages for a comic book writer. J.M. DeMatteis was just saying this online a couple of days ago. I heard Tom King say the same thing last year at some point. The difference between 20 and 22 is unreal for a comic book writer. People have no idea. So it presents challenges. So what I was working with, what I came in with was, I said, the glory of what we're doing with the new Golden Age is that we're revisiting these characters at a particular point in continuity and in canon. And though we know an awful lot about Alan Scott, some of it conflicting with some of the stuff we thought we knew over the many, many decades that we've enjoyed him in at DC. You know, in the beginning, it was much more simple. His story was very straightforward and very simple. So my instinct was to stick as close as we could to the Golden Age, to the very early origins of the character, which a lot of readers today are not familiar with, which presented challenges, sort of reintroducing some information that folks are not necessarily up on in terms of his power set and how weird it is and how he came to be. Some of the characters you meet in our book are characters from the original origin story that maybe only had a page or not even a couple of panels. And so we've kind of fleshed them out a little bit and given them more dimension. So for me, that was the major guidepost. Now, having said that, there's a lot that's happened with the character, including the fact that he came out of the closet a few years ago, that you can't ignore. So I as much as I could, I've tried to stay true to as many of the major facets of, you know, who this character is, what he's been, what his adventures have been. I'm not I just have no interest in writing anything out of continuity or, you know, redoing something or writing over something. In a perfect world, it all happened. And the beauty of the magic of the Emerald Flame and Alan's power set and the fact that he's been around for, you know, 80 years or more is that it affords you the opportunity to explain things away in a very, you know, easy way to say, well, it's magic. There's not really a lot. Yes, it all happened because, you know, magic will allow for that. So as much as possible, I've tried to do that. Now, in terms of your other part of the question, the Elton John AIDS Foundation, that was something that came up. That was not part of the original pitch. It was something that came about when the preview pages for issue one dropped. And there were a lot of opportunistic folks online and on social media who, you know, used those pages and made up stories and told lies about what the book was going to be about and to try to get clicks, I think. And there's a whole industry that just works off of that. And unfortunately, the folks who are victimized by that very often are already marginalized groups. And I felt like a lot of the people who this book represents and who might pick up this book, who feel represented by this book, would see these things and feel like we're just repeating a refrain that we've heard before from people who, you know, have a political agenda. And I said, you know, I wanted to get out and make a real statement to say, buy the heck out of this book, to prove people wrong, to say, hey, there's an audience out there. There are people who want stories like this and who embrace a story like this and think it has a place in comics. And but I felt that if I'm going to go out there and say buy this book, mm-hmm. that if I'm collecting royalties off of every issue that's sold, then it's easily sort of written off as, well, this guy just right. wants to line his pockets. And that's just not why I'm here. So I said, look, I'm just going to give away every cent I make in royalties off of these six issues to my charity of choice, which happens to be and has always been the Elton John AIDS Foundation, which I just think is a great organization that's provided palliative care and has set an incredible vision for mm-hmm. The end of HIV AIDS, and has for a long time, and worked really hard for a long time to see that happen. That was where that came from. It wasn't part of the pitch. I didn't tell DC I was going to make that announcement. You know, I just went out and did it, and then was hoping that it wouldn't make too many waves. It made a couple of waves though.
So I actually really love that because just on a personal note, my Uncle David passed away from AIDS when I was about 10 in 1995. Man, sorry. And he's also the reason why I'm into comics. He left me his entire collection and, I read them back and forth. And it's just really kind of led me in the direction of where I am now, selling comics at your LCS. And I guess really my question is, Alan Scott's roommate at Arkham Asylum, Billy, the drag queen, who unfortunately gets removed from herself, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, was there someone in your life that inspired that, both tragic but also very inspirational aspect of the story?
Well, first of all, I'm very sorry to hear about your uncle, but what a wonderful legacy to have left in you and that comic book collection, and look where you are today. I'm very happy that you actually told me that story because it really ties into the answer to your question. I'm sorry? Say again?
I really, really wish he had a chance to read your story.
Oh, yeah. Legacy, well, he lives in you. legacy is a big part of this book, although we haven't gone into great detail on that yet, and I don't want to spoil anything, but legacy is an important part of it. And the legacy that your uncle left and leaves behind, not just for you, but for people like me. I believe you said he passed away in 1995. That was the year that I came out of the closet. And in a place and a time when it was not safe really to do that. Yeah. And I wish I could say that it was better today. In some places it is, and in some ways it is, but we still have a long way to go. And also, I can't say that Alan Scott in his time wouldn't have had it even worse. There were certain truths that were passed down from the generations before me to me and to my peers that are present, that are part of this story, that are things that are important for everyone to know. It's not a lesson, it's not a textbook, but I think that stories and storytelling are so important because it's how we connect with each other. And when we feel like we don't understand each other, or we feel like we're very different or alienated from each other, we hear each other's stories. And if we hear things in those stories that we can identify with people that we never thought we would identify with, then a connection is made. And I think everybody gets better and we all get more kind. And the world gets to be a better place, hopefully, because of it. Hopefully that's how this story will leave Alan Scott and his story in a place that gives us hope for the future, even though we're telling the story set in the past. But in terms of specific people that have passed on that legacy, in terms of Billy in particular, Billy, who, by the way, I'm glad you said drag queen, only because it's left completely vague in the book how Billy would identify today.
Right.
Billy
yeah.
may be a drag queen. Billy may be trans. Billy may be a gay man who's, you know, cross-dressing and experimenting with things. I mean, there are all kinds of different answers to Billy's identity in the story. And I think it's important to, because I don't think it's very important what the details are, unless Billy wants to share them with you. But the overarching important piece of Billy's story is that Billy is queer and Billy is ostracized and ultimately victimized for her queerness. And in a very real way, in a way that historically is very accurate. Bill, by the way, this is a character that's based on the character Billings. Mr. Billings was in the origin story, who was the one who created the Green Lantern power battery. And
wow.
And was an inmate in an insane asylum. And when in the creation of the power battery, the lantern was miraculously cured. We've taken a slightly different spin on that. Obviously there are people who believe at the end of issue 2 that Billy has been cured because of the process that they've put her through, the trauma that they've put her through, but you know, they're you know, that's where we left off on Billy's story, and there is more, I'm sure, to tell. But specifically, I'm so sorry, long-winded answer.
No, by all means.
There are several people in my life who influenced how I approached writing the character Billy. Chief among them was someone who, I won't go into too much detail because he's no longer with us, but he really valued his privacy in a way that he was so mad if I went into too much detail. But he was a gay man who grew up, he was a generation before me, and he grew up in a different time, in a different place, and saw a lot of the things that I am trying to communicate and put on the page here, and communicated them to me. So this is in some ways a way of passing on the stories that he passed on to me. But he's not the only one. There are several others. There's a person in particular who I never really had much interaction with, who visually looks exactly like Billy, who I used to hang around with in bars in Los Angeles, and I would see her all over town. And it's funny to me that I didn't draw Billy, and Billy is very much Billings from Secret Origins 18 and All American 16. If you compare them, it's Kian has done a really good job of just sort of updating, but not too much, the character as they've always existed. And, but every time it's remarkable, the likeness. And every time I see her in the book, I'm reminded of this very brave, person, you know, who I used to hang around with, you know, back in my youth. Anyway, like I said, long-winded answer, but it's the point is, I think that the legacy, hopefully, that you'll see as we get through issue 5 and 6, especially 6, is, you know, legacy is a huge part of this story, and it's a huge part of our life as human beings. Now, I can also speak as a queer person and say that legacy is really important for queer stories and queer people. But I think that's just, you can take out the word queer and insert any sort of adjective there. You know, any community, I think we, you know, there is an importance to passing on our stories, you know, to the next generation. And I'm very grateful that DC has given me an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think DC has been, you know, great about this too, because especially, like, it almost seems like it's almost a creator-owned book. I mean, just with the freedom that you've been allowed to do it. I mean, going to the editors with your pitch about this and then just putting it to paper. I mean, how's the, you know, the conversations been about that?
Here's the thing. The only creator-owned books are creator-owned books. I mean, the only books with the kind of you know, just the kind of total freedom that you have in, you know, anybody will tell you in comics,
sure,
you know, are going to be creator owned. But it's not that DC has put any shackles on me. Mm. In fact, quite the opposite. They've been incredibly supportive and excited, and you know, they dove in you know, to this story head first. Andrew Marino has been a champion from day one, you know, in from, you know, in editorial, and you know, it's been a pretty remarkable experience in that respect. I chalk some of it up to when we first started, you know, this was part of the New Golden Age initiative that Jeff Johns mm-hmm. was overseeing, and you know, he's since left DC and started, you know, his company, and but there, you know, there was a coming out of Flashpoint Beyond and going into this and having sort of Jeff in the background in the beginning, I think helped sort of lend some, you know, a little bit of legitimacy to feel like, okay, let's just let Tim cook. And, yeah. And that was, and I know that Jeff was very supportive in that way in the beginning. So I'm very grateful to him for that. But I would say that in terms of like, and I wouldn't even say it's like restrictions, but in terms of guardrails that are up for me been in terms of writing this, it's more about the fans. You know, there, when you have a character that has such a history and so many layers of canon and sometimes conflicting layers of canon, there are fans who, and this is something I really learned on Masters of the Universe with Kevin Smith. You know, there, when you have a property like this and a character like this that's been around for so long, fans have a lot of headcanon to try to make things make sense, stuff mm-hmm. that doesn't make sense on the page, but you know, you try to make sense out of it and tell the story to yourself in a way that you can make sense out of it. And there's no way that a creator can come in and reach into your head and pull out your particular headcanon and give it back to you exactly as you've envisioned it. So we do our best, and we try to, sometimes we write from our own headcanon, you know, a patchwork quilt that we've put together. But it still gives you, knowing those things gives you a sense of what's important, you know, what is important to fans about the character are the things that are important about the character. Otherwise we're shouting into empty rooms, I think. And so, so listening to fans and the stuff that they've been most concerned about, I got to tell you, there've been so many people who I see on the internet who either rush to judgment about, you know, Alan Scott, or did when he first came out of the closet, about what this meant for Jade and Obsidian. And, you know, and a lot of people have come to the conclusion that Jade and Obsidian can't possibly exist if Alan Scott was gay, you know, and, I
like they're
felt
they're
like
right
it's
there.
Important. he came out to them.
Yeah,
it's right there.
I try to remind people, like, he came out to them. They exist. They're here. It's not a mean-spirited question. There's a lot of people who just don't understand. Their life experience is different than mine or maybe yours, and that's not something that they understand, is the fact that somebody in the 40s could be in the closet living a gay lifestyle, perhaps, or a gay life, you know, and still presenting as straight, or living a life that is straight, marrying and, you know, and even fathering children, and you know,
negative,
that's how a lot of people lived their life and got by, you know.
A modern interpretation would be that we see on screen is Negative Man on HBO's Doom Patrol.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, Larry was in the closet the whole time, but he did have a family. He did have two kids.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of Matt Bomer, I couldn't believe when this book came out was the same time that his show Fellow Travelers came out on Showtime. Mm-hmm. And it's so similar thematically in terms of a closeted gay man with a certain level of power you know, in this case, it was in the government, you know, engaging in an illicit love affair with another man. And that's what that story is. And I just was blown away by that. I had to stop watching it because I didn't want to like be influenced by how great it was. But I've gone back since I finished the book and watched the show. Say again.
I didn't want to steal any ideas from them.
Well, really, there was another, my comic book guy suggested a book called Parallel by Matthias Lehmann. I'm probably slaughtering his name and I apologize, but it's an original graphic novel that is also has a similar, it's even like in the 1930s or 40s and has a similar sort of theme to it. And I got it, picked up a copy of it, and I started reading a couple pages. I said, I have to put it down because I'm not done writing Alan Scott yet. I don't want to be influenced by these amazing stories, you know? But there's so much. I feel like the universe is conspiring to tell our stories like this in a way, in this particular version and viewpoint on our story right now at this point in time. And it feels like we're in the middle of the tempest right now. And so it's, you know, just a great privilege to get to tell Alan's story, which is the story of so many people, people like him.
Now, what's interesting, you're also talking about the history of everything and the fact that you're placing this, you know, right around 1941. So we, you know, you definitely saw the, hello, I'm Red Lantern. You know, I was getting the very hard red Soviet vibe, you know, he's have the Bush for dinner. Considering
Vladimir Sokol.
Exactly. What was that like for you writing these characters, especially considering today's climate, especially with what's going on in Eastern Europe? Like, was there any intrepidations about that?
No, it's interesting that the climate for early 1941, from my viewpoint, is not all that different from the climate today in terms of the United States and the Soviet Union versus today, the United States and Russia. Although I would say even in 1941, we were more, I think there was a little bit more, there was less trepidation in the early 1940s. It was post-World War II. And I think when the Red Scare really, you know, happened and when all of the anti-communist fervor was whipped up in this country. But I think there was a little bit less like there was a little bit more, I think, you do your thing, we'll do our thing back then. Somewhat today, it's been a little bit of that until the Ukraine invasion. I think that it's been a little bit, you do your thing, we'll do our thing. So it's not a totally dissimilar feeling, I think, between the two nations today versus then. So in some ways, that's very liberating. But you know, whenever you're writing anything with historical context, it's very important to me to try to get as much right as we can get right. Not just in terms of the details and the minutia of the costumes and the setting and but the attitudes and the feelings of the time. And you know, there was potentially growing animosity and ambition. With Stalin and with his regime, you know, that was happening sort of under the surface that everyday Americans weren't really aware of at the time. We were more focused at that point on what was happening in Germany and in Europe. And that's why, you know, at the end of 1941 is when we entered, World War II. And so this is this story takes place right before that. And that there are great geopolitical, and you'll see this in issue 5, there are great geopolitical doings a transpiring, for lack of a better term. Yeah. There are things happening in the world, and those things are coming to our shore, and it is becoming undeniable that America is going to have to get involved in some way, and not just America, but our greatest heroes, the JSA. And so look forward to that in issue 5. And that will continue into issue 6. in many ways setting the stage for, I think, what really happened historically, not just in the world, but in the canon of DC, where we saw the JSA go to war.
Yeah, because I mean that's such an impactful moment too. Because I mean, when the JSA kicks everything off, and we have seen a lot of the JSA members come through here, especially the early stages of Jay Garrick and the Spectre too. I mean, when you were kind of going in the stories, were you picking and choosing who you wanted to bring in for this, and how has that, you know, impacted Alan's story?
I mean, a little bit. Like I, you know, like I said, nobody put any restrictions on me, or you know, or asked me for anything. There was originally, I think the part of the Spectre originally in issue 3, which I think was actually in issue 2 in the early, would have been in issue 2 in the earliest version of the story.
Those two was extra pages, really, you had to push it back.
Yeah, right. No, we actually made some big changes to issue 1, which were necessary, that came as a suggestion from Andrew and Marquise in editorial, and they were great suggestions. And it was about cutting back to 1941. There was a lot that took place in 1936 in that issue. And originally it was conceived to take place in 1936. And they were like, well, we really need to get the 1941 story started in issue 1. So let's sort of find ways to jumpstart that and put that in. And I think that was right. And so it ended up sort of, you know, that's good editing, by the way. but that's what led to sort of issue 3 becoming the issue with the Spectre and the investigation into the murders. Originally, that was going to be Jay Garrick, who was accompanying Alan on that investigation. But as I got into it, and as I got into writing the story, you know, the idea of resurrection became a big part of the story. And if I've given a new shine to anything in Alan Scott's origin story, and like I said, I'm not here to change and upend anything, but right. If I've put a new spin on anything, it is this, and it is that Alan died in the train wreck that took the life of Jimmy Henson and everyone else on board that train, that right before he was endowed with the powers of the Green Lantern. The Emerald Flame resurrected him in the same way that the Crimson Flame resurrected, you know, Johnny Ladd, AKA Vladimir Sokov. And so once resurrection kind of came into the equation for me, I thought that the Spectre would be a really good messenger, a really good deliverer of the message to Alan, you know, not only then as somebody who can identify with being someone who lived a life, lost his life, and is back to do something else, but also as sort of, you know, as God's hand of vengeance, in many ways he stands in as you know, the voice of DC's version of, you know, God, in this story. And so, you know, it's sort of whatever that means, and you can see it in issue 3, what that means for these characters at least.
Right.
But even in that, I didn't want to stray too far from what we know about the Spectre. Now there's a lot of folks who were upset, and they said, well, there was an issue of the Spectre in the 90s where he was shown to be homophobic. And, you know, I think that's actually pretty fair. There was an issue in which we dealt with the topic of homophobia as it was experienced, you know, by the Spectre and by Jim Corrigan. And, you know, he approached it, he had a lot of questions about it. And the answers he got from the divine, you know, continuum were, you know, was that that's basically not your business. Like, you know, that's not what we're here for. You're here to take care of the murderers and the thieves, like, you know, the people who are going about their lives and loving however they love is not our concern. It's kind of the message that ultimately he had to learn, the lesson he had to learn in that issue. I think in our issue 3, you see a Spectre who is new on the job, Maybe it's like, you know, when you're new on the job and you, you know, you really, you read that manual right when you started your job and you're like, you're really good about knowing all the pieces mm-hmm. of your job and what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to
right,
do it.
Right.
He's pretty solid about that message. In 50 years time in the 90s, he will have lost sight of that perhaps, you know, going through various crises and what have you, things might be a little bit different. And that maybe that explains the Ostrander issue in which he is trying to figure that out again. But it's still part of the original message of the Ostrander book, I believe. So we're true to the spirit of the whole thing. And if you're going to be true to anything with the Spectre, it should be the spirit.
What's funny is every time I read Spectre, do you know who I hear in my head? Alan Rickman from Dogma.
I just
think he just comes off that perfectly dry to do that character.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's just me in my head.
I also got obsessed with the idea that Spectre would be funny. And like, I figured, because he literally just died and became right. Spectre in continuity. Like, this would have
got all the emotions.
Say again?
He's got all these emotions. He's still working through.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys. I don't know if you know anything about Doctor Who, but there's like whenever the Doctor regenerates, there's this great period of time, and sometimes it only lasts a minute, sometimes it lasts an episode or more, where he's not quite done cooking yet. Like, he doesn't really know who he is. He was one guy, now he's another person, and he's trying to figure it out. And that lends to a lot of fun and comedy, and it's really interesting. Fish fingers and custard. That's right. I felt like that should be where the Spectre is right now. He has a line about that. He says, look, he says one thing. He says, I'm sorry, I didn't mean for that to come out as funny, but I guess it did. And he says, he says something like, I only recently died and became an agent of the Almighty. You know, you're not the only one having an identity crisis, Alan Scott. I just thought that was kind of fun. I thought it's the only time we're going to be able to have fun with the Spectre like that, because we know that he's not much fun later on. So why not take advantage of it and strike while the iron's hot?
By
all means, because like I say, that's one of the dynamics too. Like I say, for issue 3, that stood out to me is seeing that kind of just back and forth between Alan Scott and the Spectre too. Because obviously, you know, we see him now in later times, just how they interact. Like, I think that's just another fun aspect of this book.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, I think they ended up being quite a little buddy cop duo. And if nothing else, that issue is definitely my pitch for, you know, a Spectre miniseries. I would love to see Spectre in 1940, 1941. I'd like to go back and redo his little origin vignette. Wow, and
what a great segue to my question.
Oh, all right.
Well, since we're working in the golden age, who's somebody you would definitely like to bring out, you know, from the mothballs, or someone that needs their new time to shine?
Besides the Spectre. I mean, first of all, Spectre is probably number one on my list. But otherwise, I don't know. Maybe golden age Blue Beetle. But
someone call Josh.
Called Josh Trujillo.
Yeah, we'll put it all together. Dan, Josh, Ted, everybody.
It's true. I love Josh, by the way. He's
Josh is great.
We've been friends for years. He's a great guy, and very talented. So I don't want to take Blue Beetle from him. I would say this. I think there are. I don't want to spoil anything for like pitches that I have out there in the world. But I will say this. I think there is room for, in a concept like the new golden age, I think there is room for one, if not two, golden age versions of heroes that we may know today. Not unlike the Red Lantern, Vladimir Sokov, that maybe we haven't seen their story before. I think there's a couple of folks who I would like to see a golden age incarnation of, who we've never gotten a golden age incarnation of. And this would be the place camera. To do it.
We can talk off camera.
All right. Perfect.
No, absolutely. Now I'm sorry to get like, who would be great? Who'd be,
I mean, all I'm hoping
who
is
do you that, think?
And well, I'll be honest, who I don't want. All right. Cause I think that where they stand is one thing. And I don't think that, you know, back you know, backdating these types of characters. Because once I saw Red Lantern, I'm like, oh, okay. And my mind went straight to Blackest Night and everything that went, you know, on with that. So I'm hoping we don't get oranges and yellows and purples and da-da-da-da back then. I mean, I wouldn't mind, like, seeing Sayre Waverly or Waverly Sayre, because we actually live close to there and we still don't understand why there was a lantern named Waverly Sayre. It was a one-shot and back in the Wild Wild West. Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Green Lantern from Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally don't want to see other multicolored lanterns from the Golden Age. I'm liking what I got with red and green.
I'm going to go out there and say I disagree.
That's fine. That's what we do. Ooh.
Here we go. Drama. Let's go. Fisticuffs.
Yeah.
Well, we already got Solomon Grundy, who's supposed to be like the agent of the gray, which I thought was pretty cool when they did that in Earth 2. And
you know, I have to say, we did stretch continuity a little bit in including Solomon Grundy on page one of the Alan Scott book. You see him in a newspaper headline. Solomon Grundy didn't appear in the comics until a few years after 1941. But I am taking creative license on that one and saying maybe he was around a little bit more. You just didn't know.
I mean, he's a zombie. He can be around for as long as, you know, he's been dead.
As long as
yeah. Cyrus Gold is in the swamp, I think, right? Yeah.
Right.
So wait, you say you disagree, though. Do you disagree because there's a particular version of a lantern color that you'd like to see a Golden Age version of?
Well, since Obsidian's powers are shadow-based, the Black Lantern would still be very interesting from that perspective. And I don't know, I've always been a huge Green Lantern fan. I'm going to get a little close to the camera for a second and show you this, which I'm particularly excited about.
Oh, yes. Yeah, oh, yeah. Wait. How long have you had that?
I've been a huge Green Lantern fan for a very long time.
I saw somebody making those online recently, and I need to reach out to him. They're beautiful. That's a beautiful.
So I don't think he's making them currently, but I'm pretty sure that if you told him who you were, he would absolutely make you one, 100%. And I'll send you the information for him after the show.
I can tell him who I was, but maybe I want to tell him who I want to be. that's fantastic. I don't have an Alan Scott ring. I'm so mad about it.
A friend of mine has been
building one, has been making one for his own cosplay. And I'm watching, just drooling, you know. And also, this guy that I saw online and making—he makes a Red Lantern a ring as well.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Same guy.
Yeah.
You can actually do it in any color you want. It's just those were the two big ones because obviously, the Green Lantern, huge. And then you know when you announced, or when it was announced that there would be a Red Lantern in, was it?
But you know,
Frontier.
You know, Tom. I have to say, I can see what you're saying. Like, I agree. Mm-hmm. Like, there's something about the Red Lantern and this particular Red Lantern and being Red Lantern because he's the Soviet Union's version of the Green Lantern that,
yeah,
like a lot of pieces come together and conspire to make that make sense in the continuity. And, but if you started doing it with a lot of other ones, maybe it would get a little silly. Maybe. I don't know. It depends who did it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like I say, there's so many like great characters you could use from that. Mm. Like I say, I mean, I would love to see like an orange one. Because I think like at that time you could do some really cool kind of, you know, double dealings in the 40s too, especially with just like how, you know, the United States is kind of forming. And, you know, like I say, in this next wave.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I love about comics. We all can have opinions about it. And we'll all still be friends.
That's right.
It could be like anything.
By the way, speaking of that, and again, I don't want to spoil anything, but issue 5, I know you guys have waited a while for this, but in issue 5, there is some more, shall we say, cosmic context that is brought to Alan's powers, the Emerald Flame, the Crimson Flame, all of that stuff that I know is probably, it's not hindering your enjoyment of the story, obviously, but it's stuff that maybe little questions have been popping up for you. hopefully we'll answer a few of those for you in issue 5. So please do check that out.
Now, you know, with all the issues that have been coming out, and you've had all these phenomenal covers that have been coming, and, you know, our guy in the chair has put up so many of them.
David Tulaski with those A covers. Like, yes. How beautiful. How beautiful are these covers?
And I personally love the toy covers. Are incredible.
Or the variant covers are incredible too, but those Tulaski covers blow me away. Issue 1, I mean, it's reintroducing the character to the world. That's Nick Robles. I mean, you know, these are to me instant classic covers. They're absolutely beautiful. Travis Moore, it's incredible. Yeah. Yeah, look at that. That issue 2 cover knocked me out because
it's
not always the case that the cover gives you, it's not always the case that you can judge a book by its cover, right? You look at that cover for issue 2, the A cover from Tulaski, and it tells you what this issue, it tells you. Mm-hmm. It gives you the sense of what you're going to feel in this issue. It doesn't tell you a ton about the story in terms of the plot, but it tells you an awful lot about how you're going to feel, you know, if you really open yourself up to that story, which is incredible. And it's an embarrassment of riches for a writer to, you know, to see these covers come in. I just can't believe how beautiful they are.
Now, when it comes to that, when you were writing the scripts and all this beautiful art that keeps coming up, what is it for you that, you know, did you really have to, you know, put a side on there that says scene in the library, this, that, and the other thing? Or did you just let your guys go and see what they were able to bring out and then you tweaked it from there?
Yeah, some writers, I guess, do it differently. I come from the world of animation. That's where I started my career. And I'm accustomed to writing a blueprint for the movie in my head. So the movie that's in my head, I will try on the page to describe to you in as much detail as I can without bogging it down, the important details or some of the interesting flourishes that I've seen in my head that will help inspire you, the artist, to bring this thing to life and realize it in a whole new way. And what I always tell, I told this to Kian, I tell this to Kian at the beginning of every issue as we're working, you know, I put it in the script or I'll tell him, I'll text him. But, and I say this to every artist I ever work with, is you can throw all the description that I've put in there out the door. You can even pitch me on getting rid of dialogue. And, you know, like in a perfect world, the art is so good, you can just throw out all the balloons because the art tells the whole story and you don't even need balloons. You know, that's a difficult task and not everybody, you know, could ever achieve that. But sometimes you get one. Sometimes I'll get a panel and I'll be like, take the balloon out. We don't need it anymore because, you know, what's here is so perfect. And communicates even more than what I can do in a balloon. So I will say, throw it all out. But I put it here for you to tell you the movie that's in my head and hopefully to inspire you to envision a whole new take on the movie. And if you're stuck on something, I would hate to not give you details, you know, and ideas for a panel and have you be stuck on it for, you know, 2 days rather than if I just told you, yeah, this is probably just at a desk. It's a close up on a hand and he's doing this or whatever, you know, that might open up the door to creativity for the artist to say, oh no, wait, I know how to do this. So I just think that's the way we collaborate. That's the best way we can work. And some artists work well that way. Some artists don't want to work that way. With Kian in particular, that's how we've worked. I'll put too much information in every panel description and certainly too much dialogue. And then I will also go in, we found early on this really helped. I will go in and highlight like really specific stuff that I think, regardless of all the other stuff I've put in here, all the detail, these are the things that we definitely want to take away from this panel. And so I'll highlight those in addition to, you know, having written it all, just to give him a guide to say, you know, I can throw it all out, but we do want to remember that this is going to come up on page 10 later on. So we don't want to lose this thing completely because we need to reference it later or something like that. So it's actually been quite fluid and really a great relationship. I don't know how to write otherwise. I don't know how. I know other writers work differently. I mean, one of my best friends is Jeremy Adams, and sometimes he gets really detailed in the panel description, and sometimes he will be, you know, he's just getting to the next thing, and it's, he also trusts the artist to be able to just do it on their own. It's not that I don't trust the artist. It's that I don't trust myself to not say anything and then know that I've communicated in dialogue or in other ways in the story what ought to be there in the panel. So I, you know, that's the way I write. I think there's a lot of people who write like that. We put the blueprint together. If I could, I offer this to artists too, when I work with them, which is the way Alan Burnett is a legendary writer and producer from animation. He was one of my mentors. And he you know him from Batman, the Animated Series, and he's been writing with Paul Dini, Adventures Continue comics that have been very popular. Alan, when I first embarked on writing comics, I asked for his advice, and he said, try to keep it to 5 panels a page, which everybody says, and that's great advice. And he said, also, if you find you're uncomfortable, just write it like a teleplay, write it like a screenplay, write it the way you would write a TV episode, and deliver that. And the artist will then interpret, you know, that in a way that they will break out panels and pages and figure out how to make it work. That's a big ask for an artist,
right?
To say, here's a format you're not accustomed to working in, translate it, you know? So I've never done that, but I've always offered it to every artist to say, look, I don't know if you've ever worked that way, or if you would feel that that's something you want to try. I certainly feel more comfortable writing in a screenplay format than I do writing in the comic book format that I use, which is an adapted version of the way Jeff Johns writes a comic script, which is random because I before I ever met Jeff, I was given a sample of a script that he had written for Shazam, and I used that as my sort of baseline and have tweaked it a little bit, but not much. I mostly write the way Jeff writes. By the way, I gave the same script to Jeremy Adams when he started on Flash, and the Jeff script. And so the both of us were writing very much in the style that Jeff writes in. So then when we started working on Flashpoint Beyond, I've never asked Jeff, but I can only imagine that whenever we would turn in pages, you know, and share them with each other, when he would get pages from us, it must've been very easy for him to read because it was in his style,
right?
You know, the way he would put the page together. Because some people just don't do that. But anyway, I always offer it. No artist has yet taken me up on, yeah, write a screenplay and I'll translate it into comic book pages someday, maybe.
Oh yeah. You got to put that karma out there. Cause definitely, like I say, this story is just prime example. Like, you gotta be doing that. And obviously with this story too, I know it's only scheduled to go 6 issues. All right, can we expect maybe another Alan Scott story down the road?
I don't know. Excuse me. I told you it was coming.
Knock on wood.
Knock on wood. Yeah, I don't know.
Knock on wood.
Knock on wood.
You know, listen. Speaking of, you'll notice there's been precious little discussion of Alan Scott's weakness to you know, his ring's weakness to wood.
We have.
What's that?
We have.
You've noticed. Here's the thing. That's speaking of future stories for Alan Scott. That is it's a very interesting, I'm sure there's a really interesting story to be told. And there have been interesting versions of why that is, why that weakness exists for him. For me, in 6 issues and 20 pages an issue, to tell that part of his story, I felt was stopping us dead. It was stopping the story dead to do a thing that was ultimately maybe just going to come off as sort of Easter eggy or fan servicey. And I made a decision at a certain point to, if it came up organically, you know, then we would include something in the story about that. But otherwise I wasn't going to hold myself to having to explain that or talk about the wood weakness, the wood impurity, I guess.
So if I could interject real quick, I have a, so obviously comic book guy, I talk about comics all day long. We theorize, we come up with like crazy, you know, ideas on how things should work. And I always had this thought about why wood specifically. And it's both simple and kind of complex at the same time. But if you think about it, so Alan's, you know, he's set in the 40s, right? And he's fighting against like mostly gangsters, mobsters, stuff like that. And the weapons they usually have are like guns or chains or lead pipes or baseball bats, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, they come at him with the gun, bullets bounce off of him. They come at him with the chain, does nothing. They come at him with the lead pipe, does nothing. They hit him with the baseball bat. Oh my God, it took him out. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of talk about how the Emerald Flame is the flame of life, right? And of those objects, the baseball bat is the only organic object. So it's the only thing that's ever been alive. So in my mind, it's not necessarily
anymore.
It isn't anymore. But even then, a dead piece of wood still has life within it, with the bacteria and the things that are like living inside of it, etc. And it was always in my mind that Alan's ring just can't affect living things like that. Like anytime he uses the ring to burn or, you know, create fire, it never necessarily burns anyone. And anytime I see him kill someone in the Golden Age, it's always they fall off of a building or, you know, a Ferris wheel or something. They never get killed by the ring itself. They get killed by the environment around them, the circumstances.
It's very interesting. You tell me you haven't read issue 5 yet, but
I haven't given it to anybody.
Green Lantern. I've read a lot of Green Lantern.
Well, there's a couple of things in issue 5 that might help point you, you know, in a similar direction. And
okay,
That might you might consider line up with your views on that.
I like that.
But all in all, by the way, the other thing was, look, everybody's gonna. Once Alan Scott came out of the closet, everybody has been making jokes about his weakness to wood. And we all knew that that was ha, 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 funny, funny, funny. Everybody made the joke. The joke is played out.
Yeah.
It was funny. Even I laughed. I probably made the joke in the beginning too. I've had, you know, weak moments like that, but you know, it's just not worth getting into all of that in this book for me. There are bigger fish to fry at this point, but that's not to say if we've written it out, it's not that it's not part of his story. It is very much in my mind part of his story, but Alan is figuring out his powers in this book. He doesn't have a guide. He doesn't have guardians. He doesn't have anyone teaching him or telling him, you know, what this is. He hasn't yet. The closest thing he has now is Vladimir. Say again.
He and Hal Jordan have that in common.
Right. The closest thing he has now, I mean, although Hal gets, you know,
eventually training. He gets trained.
Yeah. But there is nobody to train Alan Scott. So he's getting some information from Vladimir. And he's going to get some more information as well in issue 5. But he's still figuring it all out. And I think there are lots of ways in which, not knowing what your weaknesses are might allow you to avoid being weakened by them or being weak to them. And once he learns about what they are, then that's when they're going to become a problem. But that's for another story for another day, which, by the way, just bring it all the way back around, was ultimately, I think, where this question started, which is future stories and incarnations for this version of Alan Scott and this character. And, and I say this version, but I mean, this is the version in 1941. This is the Alan Scott of main continuity. It's just, we're seeing him as a young man. And I think there's, what I want to do is leave the toys in a place when I'm done playing with them, where somebody else can come in and pick them up and tell some of these stories and tell more of these stories. I certainly have other stories I'd like to tell, but there's a lot of other folks too who you should have their voices, you know, added into that chorus. And so I hope that there will be more. I really do. I hope that this book has, you know, look, Alan Scott didn't have a title for like almost 75 years.
Yeah.
Until this story. And And the fact that, you know, that you go into, I go into my local comic shop, I can't find a copy of issues 1, 2, 3, or 4. That's the story, at least all over my town. And it's probably the story in a lot of towns. Cause people have responded to it. They've picked it up and it means the world to all of us who've worked really hard on this story. But it also is an indicator that maybe there's life in these golden age heroes yet. Maybe there'll be more stories in the future. Let's hope.
Absolutely. Cause I mean, obviously this whole series has been such an incredible read from honestly issue 1 to now, and what's coming out in issue 5, dropping at the comic shops on March 25th. We can't stress that enough. And honestly, if you have not picked up this series, by the time you get done watching this on YouTube or in podcast form, make sure you run out to your comic shop, see if you can get some copies, because they are selling like hotcakes. You don't want to miss out on what's going on with this, because this is truly one story that just stands out from everything else on the shelf right now. If you like action, you like adventure, you like romance, drama, there's a QR code above Tom right now that's comicshoplocator.com. So no excuse for you not to go. Click that, find out where your comic shop is, run down there and demand that they have this series in stock, and literally buy as many copies as you can, because this is something truly special and is well worth the addition to your collection. Tim, I know
Thank
we're running
up against... Go there on March 26th, though. Don't go on Monday. Go on Tuesday, the 26th.
We're excited. We want it now, damn it.
Yeah.
I want it out there now, too, but I don't want people showing up on the 25th being disappointed.
Yes. Well, see, I get so excited. I just got to pregame it out for the night before, like to make sure the alarm is set for the 26th. And obviously go get as many copies as you can. Tim, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk with us. We have the links for you and the Elton John's AIDS Foundation in the liner notes of this YouTube show, and it will be in the podcast form as well.
That's great. Thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. And again, thank you so much for everything, for your kindness. It's been incredible.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much. For Tom and Justin, thank you guys for coming on the show. My name is Ken M, and we're going to end this like we always do. When you're at the comic shop and you have a great issue in your hand, such as Alan Scott, the Green Lantern, and you see somebody struggling to find something, hand yours off to him. Tell him to turn a page. We'll see you next time.